Currently, around the world, agriculture is rethinking its place in society. And at the same time, society is thinking about what it is that it expects from agriculture. One expectation that has always been there and probably won't change is the expectation that agriculture is going to provide an abundant source of high-quality food and fiber, and that people will be able to afford that. But it has always been the case that that agricultural policy has involved more than just agriculture. It has involved social policy as well, economic policy, and more it's becoming environmental and conservation policy as well. Now we'll see if we can talk about some of these issues, how people are thinking about them this morning, with Peter Bloom. He is one of the assistant directors of Illinois' Cooperative Extension Service. It's something that I know he has thought about a good deal and has written about as well. And as we talk, we certainly want to involve people who are listening. We'd like to get your thoughts and your comments too. Our telephone number here locally, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you very much for coming over to talk with us.
Well, it's my pleasure, David.
Why is it that this is something, and I know that's something that has occupied a lot of your thoughts, why is it that it's something that you have found yourself thinking about more and more?
I suppose I began thinking most deeply about this topic about 1985 with the 85 Food Security Act. First of all, thinking of the concept of there being a social contract for agriculture, I think, is a very useful way of trying to understand things like the Food Security Act of 1985, or trying to understand why the EEC is so difficult to negotiate with over the GATT agreement, or why Japan is so intransigent in protecting their rice industry. So I think thinking broadly about what is the agreement that each country has with its agriculture is helpful. And it's long been true in the United States that as farm numbers have declined, farmers themselves talk about their loss of political power. And so every 5 years or so, when at the national level we write a new farm bill, we understand that it takes a coalition of interests to pass a farm bill. Farmers just don't have the political power. Farmers, particularly in agriculture more generally, just doesn't have the political power to write a farm bill by itself. In 1985, some new members joined that alliance. Conservationists and environmentalists were very much involved in the writing of the 85 farm bill. And it was a farm bill that was terribly, terribly important to farmers. You may recall that we were in the midst of a farm crisis at that time. We had a great deal of excess debt in agriculture that we had to deal with somehow. And that farm bill, over the 5 years between 85 and 90, and the payments that came to farmers that totaled over $77 billion during that period, were terribly important to agriculture. Now, those new members of that alliance, I'm sure, came to the alliance with expectations. And agriculture, generally, the farmers that I was talking to, generally didn't look at the farm bill as being a contract with society. Now, the reason that it's important to raise that issue now is to ask the question that in 1995, when we're trying to write a new farm bill, who will be in the alliance? Who will vote with agriculture? And why will they vote with agriculture? I think we have to take the contract as it's represented in those farm bills terribly seriously, and think about the perspective of those other members of the alliance who were helpful in creating that farm bill.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk a little bit more about this idea of the social contract and why you see that being a force in agriculture. Because it's if if you say, well, agriculture is an industry, and then you ask the question, are there other industries that you want to invoke a social contract with, I don't know that we necessarily have that same sort of expectation, other than, yes, it's certainly true that with other industries, we expect that they're going to make useful products that we can afford, that they will employ people, and that they will do so exercising some care for their impact on the environment. But it's not somehow we don't say have the same expectations of the auto industry, for example, that we do of agriculture. What is it that makes farming different that makes us feel like we have the right, in a sense, to say to people in agriculture, we have certain expectations that we want you to fulfill, and it seems like we're not that way with other sorts of industries.
Well, I think you're picking up on a very important point, David. I think agriculture is unique in how the public relates to it, perhaps for historic reasons. We all still carry within ourselves some appreciation for that agrarian value system, if you will. But let me suggest that the public is relating to agriculture in a special way, in that it is expressing its desires to agriculture and using the carrot approach to try to achieve those goals. With other industries, we tend to use the stick. We have expectations that we express in laws, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and we enforce those expectations with a stick, with regulations. In agriculture, those expectations are coming more with the carrot. If you want to continue to have the benefits of agricultural benefits, then you have to comply with the conservation provisions of the 1985 Act. It's that which I think we need to give specific attention to. So, you know, in my judgment, agriculture wants to maintain the relationship with society, that society continues to use a carrot approach and, if you will, a voluntary approach to implement its wishes, to set the parameters, if you will, within which agriculture will operate. If, on the other hand, the groups that have joined in that alliance that drafts the farm bills come to believe that agriculture is really not going to carry out those expectations, then it's going to be very difficult for us to maintain the commodity programs of the farm bills in the future. If that's true, I don't think society is going to drop its expectations or its interests in agriculture. We might very well in the future then see more of the stick approach. But let me address the other part of your comment. Why is agriculture special? Well, agriculture is special because it uses so many of the natural resources upon which we all collectively must depend for ourselves, for the future, and for all future generations. So society has a very, very vital interest in how these essential natural resources are used. And in fact, I think we are beginning to view our producers as much as caretakers of those essential community resources as we are viewing them as producers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also represented in, if you look closely at the 85 or the 90 farm bills.
You know, I think that many farmers feel that somehow they have gotten a bad rap on this very issue, this sort of stewardship issue, mm-hmm. and will say that they are just as concerned and perhaps even more concerned with maintaining the quality of the land and the air and the water, and that is something that they have always, that has always been a high priority, and that there's, I think, some sort of maybe a little bit of resentment out there, resentment of the implication that they're careless. And again, to go back to the analogy about how we think of different industries, I think farmers are sort of saying, you know, you don't go to Lee Iacocca and look over his shoulder and tell him how he ought to be building cars. You sort of figure that he knows what he's doing and that he'll go out of business if he doesn't. And yet, at the same time, people who I think probably some farmers would say people that don't know anything about farming are doing that. They're going and they're looking over farmers' shoulders and they're trying to tell them what, you know, what they should be doing, that they ought to be doing this or that, or use less chemicals, or, you know, that they're not worried enough about soil conservation, or, you know, whatever. You know, why? How is it? It goes back to the question, the resource question. You know, how is it that we sort of feel that we have the right to do that?
Again, you've touched on a very, very important point. I enjoy working with farm audiences talking about this very topic. As you say, farmers tend to feel very much put upon. People who don't understand agriculture are expressing expectations of agriculture, are actively pursuing setting some standards for agriculture, and that makes farmers very, very concerned and very nervous. I suggest to the farm audiences that I interact with that we're probably not all that far apart with these people who are expressing these thoughts. And the way to illustrate that is to change the time frame that we're talking about. Farmers very rightly are concerned about income this year and next year. They're very rightly concerned about how are they going to meet the challenges this growing season. In fact, I think we who work closely with farmers have also taken on that kind of a short-term focus. I suggest that in the public interest, all of us need to think more long-term. And if instead of talking about this year and next year, we begin to think in terms of decades or maybe even centuries and ask this basic question, are there production practices, are there production systems that we're using today that we obviously can't be using, say, 50 years from now, two generations from now, when our grandchildren are farming that same land? And in fact, you come up with a fairly long list. Any soil erosion beyond the replacement level, beyond T, is not sustainable long term. In many parts of the United States and the world, we're mining groundwater supplies. In fact, there is planned depletion schemes on aquifers, which by definition is not sustainable. Many of the pest control practices that we've used in the past that are based on chemistry, the insects have the biological capacity to defeat those strategies. And so the strategies that we've developed are all short-term kinds of things. Today we put 10 calories of fossil energy in every calorie that we put on our plates. How are we going to do that for 5? How are we going to do that for 2? You know, those are the kinds of questions that we must face and we must deal with over the next 50 years. Now, when are we going to start thinking about them and when are we going to start doing something about them? Now, in that context, that is what I think we should be, that's the context with which we should be talking about sustainable agriculture, for example. And there, farmers' interests and your and my interests are all the same. I mean, we've got these very, very important. And that says nothing. You know, that doesn't cast any aspersions on how we've met our challenges in the past. It just simply says that we must have a broader perspective, a more long-term perspective, keeping in mind that, yes, it has to work in the short term. Farmers have to be profitable. They have to work with the tools and with the inputs that they have today. But all of us need to be carrying around this commitment to meet these challenges head on in the next 50 years. And generally, you know, environmentalists and conservationists and consumer advocates are fairly impatient. You know, they want to see evidence that we're getting on about these larger challenges. And so again, I suggest that we're not all that far apart. It may be a matter of reaction. You know, I think society has stepped up before agriculture, if you will, farmers right now, and said, look, we're very concerned about the environmental impacts of agriculture, and we're very concerned about food safety. Now, there are a whole host of reactions that could be given to that sort of thing. One of the reactions might be, you don't know what you're talking about. You weren't raised on a farm. You didn't study agricultural science. You don't understand how agriculture operates. So you're talking now about something you don't understand anything about. And because you're talking about it, you're dangerous. And so we're going to fence you off, or we're going to wall you off, or we're going to deal with you as a dangerous opponent of agricultural interest. There's another possible way to respond to those statements from the public. Another way to respond would be to say, look, we understand that about 2% of us are actively engaged in farming now, that we need to find common ground with other groups in society who have political power and influence. What are the handles that we can use? What are the topics that we can use in conversation with these other important groups in society that can lead to long-term alliances where we develop that those common interests and are able to build that into an alliance? I suggest that the public has stepped up and offered those particular handles, those topics that we can grab onto. Long term, farmers have the same interest in the environmental impacts of agriculture that consumers have. Long term, farmers have the same interest in food safety that consumers have. And so I would suggest that the response we ought to try to be cultivating is, well, so are we. You're interested in the environmental impacts of agriculture? My goodness, so are we. Let's sit down and talk about these and what might be accomplished short-term and long-term. You're interested in food safety? Goodness, so are we. So let's sit down and see where we can find our common interest and build those into long-term alliances. I'm suggesting to you, and here I'm pointing the finger at me as well as anyone else. I grew up on a farm. I studied ag science. I tend to have that kind of knee-jerk first reaction. And I think that reaction, where we build fences around ourselves as though agriculture were the center of the universe, may have been, you know, a reasonable posture to have in the past, but it just doesn't serve us very well now. And I think we have to work very hard at knocking down those fences and thinking very deeply about where does agriculture fit in with the rest of society and how can we connect with the rest of society rather than defend ourselves against the rest of society.
Hmm. Well, and we have somebody to talk with here. I hope we'll get some other callers too. Let's take this caller on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I'm very sensitive to this idea of having the standing to be able to talk about this, and I guess I should give my credentials first. I'm the son of a Ralston Purina dealer in a farming community, so though I haven't studied, I have been sensitive to these issues for quite a long time. So I think one thing to do is to hold other industries to the same sort of concept of stewardship that we're asking farmers to, and I think it's illustrated very clearly in this community that industry, you know, has to be held to not counting landfills as externalities that they don't have to worry about, not counting, you know, hazardous waste disposal. I mean, it really should go for all industries, and some industries have better lobbyists and better hands on the controls. At least that's my contention. I may differ, but talking to farmers, they are not all negative about the EEC. They've seen, and I've heard about people in my home community losing their farms and the family farm being, you know, bought up and agribusiness being called the best thing that could be done. But I've heard arguments from some farmers that, you know, they understand that the EEC and Japan have both experienced famine, and they do not want to rely on imports of basic food goods. And that, and it seems like Cargill and the exporters here and those large industrial organizations that are the ones that are really pushing the EEC subsidies down. And this is illustrated in that I think something like 7 of our GATT negotiators over time have been some people, vice presidents or some such, from Cargill and other large agribusinesses. So I just think that there are a lot of people trying to speak for farmers as well as a lot of people trying to speak to farmers, and it seems that we need to hear some more of those issues. I hope some actual farmers do call up, because I've heard some call in at various times and be very strong advocates for sustainability, etc. It isn't being imposed entirely from the outside. So I'd just like to hear some comments on some of those ideas. I'm sure you've heard some of them before.
Yeah, those are excellent ideas. Let me comment on the EEC. You often hear the notion that it's because the EEC was hungry during that the European countries were hungry during the Second World War that they have that policy. I'm not sure that that's as true today as it was then, because frankly, just as is true in this country, most of the people in the EEC just the Second World War was history. But having traveled in Europe a bit, it became apparent to me that the EEC governments are subsidizing agriculture to keep some small, non-viable farmers on the farm, just so they don't add to the unemployment rolls in the city. They are also putting some fairly strict restrictions on how they can farm. For example, there are architectural standards for barns so that they look traditional and historic. There are limitations on how silos can be built, again, so they look traditional. So how they deal with agriculture is very much involved in what they want the countryside to look like. It's almost as though they're paying those small farmers to be the caretakers of their national park system. And as you drive across much of Europe, it does look like a national park. Well, that's fascinating. That says something about the social contract in those European countries. And far be it from us to tell another country what their social contract for agriculture ought to be. Now, where we have our disagreements with the European community is primarily over how they go about conducting that social contract. For example, we would argue, please don't pay those farmers to produce commodities that you don't need, that you then dump on world markets at a highly subsidized price. In other words, be sensitive to what the impact of how you implement your policy in your country impacts other countries. And I think that's the main disagreement. And by the way, I don't suggest that we're innocent. We're far from innocent in that. So you raise that marvelous point of we need to, and it's one of the places where it's very useful to be thinking in terms of a social contract. Now, you're also very right in suggesting that our GATT negotiators are very, very, very committed to free trade, free world trade. And it's something that I've given a lot of thought to. I remind myself and I would remind others that in all countries, agricultural policy is also social policy. And so I'm not hopeful that in the short run and maybe even the long run we will see that completely open trade. Let me return, though, to the very first comment you made that we need to hold other industries to the same standards that we do for agriculture. While I have not studied what the environmental requirements are for other industries, I guess I had the perception that we are holding all of our industries. Lee Iacocca, for example, we're looking pretty carefully at his smokestack. And we're looking pretty carefully at what the effluents are from his plants, and we're holding him to standards on those, and we're imposing financial penalties if those standards aren't met. And again, that's a little bit different way than we're dealing with agriculture. I like, frankly, the way we're dealing with agriculture because it says society has an important stake in agriculture and is willing to provide benefits to agriculture. We also have these expectations of agriculture, but we're not going to tell farmers how to meet those expectations. We're going to let them find the very best way for them under their circumstances to meet those requirements. You know, what I'm speaking of here is the conservation compliance. We're really not telling farmers how to do that. There are a number of options, and I think it's terribly important that we allow farmers the freedom to determine how it is that in their own circumstances, what's the best way for them to meet those expectations that society has. Gee, that was a good set of thoughts there.
Again, our guest this morning, Peter Bloom. He is one of the assistant directors of the Illinois Cooperative Extension Service. We're talking about agriculture and its place in society. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. Yeah.
There was yet another point that that the caller made, and that was the number of people who speak for agriculture as well as to agriculture. It's another important thing to think about. I think that one of the relationships that I've reflected on is the relationship between farmers and their input industries. I think it's unique in agriculture that farmers have tended to identify more closely with their input industries than they have with their customers, with the consumers. I wonder why that is. I suppose it could be because they live more closely to their input industries. The consumers are really distant, mm-hmm. whereas the local suppliers, input suppliers, are neighbors and friends. Also, farmers have banded together and formed cooperatives and integrated vertically by owning some of those input industries. So they have a tendency to identify very closely with their input industries. Now, for their part, the input industries have a tendency to speak for agriculture. Whenever there's a question about the environmental impacts of agricultural chemicals, for example, the ag chemical companies tend to run up and throw their arms around farmers and say, "Here, let us speak for you in this issue." They also tend to project the public image for agriculture, and I witness the ads. The television ads that we see so much of here in this part of the country during the winter. I wonder if farmers are going to be able to continue to allow that to happen. I wonder if farmers aren't going to have to assert themselves and speak for themselves and suggest to others that you shouldn't speak for us, because in fact the long-term interests of farmers and the long-term interests of the input industries are not the same. And, I think that's, again, something worth reflecting on. Who speaks, who presumes to speak for farmers, and do they accurately represent what farmers really believe? And are farmers going to have to assert themselves a bit more in terms of speaking for themselves and their interests?
Hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else. We have someone on our toll-free line here. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. One relates to the decreasing political power of farmers that you mentioned. My impression is that, except for the Farm Bureau, very few farmers belong to the organizations that can lobby for them, like the Corn Growers and the Soybean Association around here in particular. Why do you think that is, and is there anything you think can be done about it? The second is, I've heard over and over again this cliche that perception is reality, so that there are no doubt millions of housewives who think that the corn and the beans that go into their cooking oil is still soaking with pesticides when it goes into the factory. And even though that's not true, they think it is, and so we have to deal politically with their perceptions as if they were real. Do you think that in the long run, is really the way to go about it?
Okay, again, a couple of very, very good questions. The first about the decreasing political power and why farmers don't join groups that can speak for them perhaps more effectively than they can speak for themselves individually. Again, I think there's this notion of independence. Farmers are very competitive and tend to view themselves as very independent. And for that reason, I think probably don't join organizations that can speak for them perhaps as much as we would expect. I guess I would say this about farmers' independence. I think farmers, in fact, if they think deeply about it, are very dependent. They're very dependent on all of the input industries to provide them with the wherewithal to farm. They're dependent upon the processing industries. They're dependent upon exporters. They're dependent upon commodity programs. So, in fact, I think farmers are very dependent, and maybe I'm using the wrong words in talking about that. Maybe interdependency is the thing that we should be talking about. We're obviously dependent upon our farmers for our food, and they are dependent upon many others in society to be able to carry out their function. So very, very interdependent. Also, I think we have to recognize that farmers have political power well beyond their numbers. And it's because of a thing that we've called the farm bloc and solidarity in terms of farm interests. So really, the group in society that has a vital interest, first-line interest in agriculture is almost 20% of our society. That's all of us who relate to agriculture in our work, in how we make a living. The question about perceptions and the perceptions of the housewife is terribly, terribly important. And I think in the past we have, well, again, to the two ways in which we can respond to this sort of a question, the you don't know what you're talking about kind of a response. Let me suggest a totally different response to those housewives. An attempt. I'm not sure that. Let me think for just a moment as to whether the pesticide residue is the. Let me turn to a bit of a different issue. Let me turn to the incidence of agricultural chemicals in groundwater and surface water and even rainwater. We have let's say an incidence of detection of agricultural chemicals in 1 or 2% of, say, our groundwater supplies that are in excess of the health advisory level for lifetime consumption. How do we talk about that with others who might use that water supply? Well, I suggest one way we might do it is to explain what a health advisory level is, to explain how that level is set, with all of the shortcomings and all of the assumptions. That we're using animal tests as a stand-in for humans, that we're using high dosage rates to try to get a shorter response time because we really can't wait for lifetime effects, that we're translating then that to humans, that we're providing some safety factors. There's the uncertainty of what the dose response curve looks like in the low dosage levels, so we're making some guesses about that. But when we put all of those things together, that the bulk of the scientific judgment is that is a safe level. Now, after you've explained all of that, you still can't say to that person, you should consider that safe, because that's a judgment that everybody has to make for themselves. What you can say is, knowing that, I have decided that that is safe for me. Furthermore, I have decided that that is safe for my family. But I really won't presume to tell you that it's safe for you. I think that's a judgment that you have to make. So that's a very different way. But again, I think a way in which we're going to have to deal with these kinds of issues. What are the scientific facts? Well, the scientific facts are that at a certain we have a certain incidence level of this at certain detection amounts. And relate those to what science has to say, but then we have to admit that we cannot presume to judge for individuals whether that's safe or not. They have to. And I think we have to very much avoid making comparisons that that'll be challenged. We often talk about parts per billion and parts per million as the number of bananas it takes to reach the moon, or a drop of gin in a tank car of vermouth, and silly things like that. That's really not a part per billion or a part per million can be made to seem very large, or it can be made to seem very small. That's not the point. Also, I think we have to be very careful in comparing risks that we voluntary risks from involuntary risks. And Peter Sandman, who's out at Rutgers University and who writes about these risk issues, says, I really don't know whether Bruce Ames, who talks about natural carcinogens in our food supply versus artificial carcinogens, whether Bruce is right or not. He said, I only know that anyone who compares what he put in my apple with what God put in my apple is going to make a lot of people outraged. And so we have to be very careful that when we talk about risks and we compare risks, that in fact we compare involuntary risks and we compare voluntary risks, but we don't mix them up. You know, it's a long answer to your question, or to your comment. In fact, perception is reality for a lot of people. How do we go about bringing their perceptions closer to reality? But I think we also have to honor everyone's right to make the final judgment for themselves as to whether the risks are acceptable or not.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Let me, you know, we've been talking about this notion of the social contract, and I think that you know, the idea of contract does imply that all parties do have rights, obligations, and so forth. And I could imagine that, you know, taking from a farmer's point of view, taking a look at consumers, one might be tempted to say, you know, you folks have had it pretty darn good for a long time now. You have abundant supply of very high quality food products, and at quite a reasonable price. And until recently, you never really cared quite where it came from or what it took to produce it, and would say things like, you know, people don't really appreciate the fact that it's very hard work. There are some years that it's very difficult to make a profit. It's a very dangerous occupation. You know, people talk about problems with the chemicals. Well, you know, who's at greatest risk for problems of exposure to chemicals? It's the people that are going to be handling the chemicals. And once you get it way down the line into the food product, the risk is so low as almost maybe not worth worrying about. From a farmer's point of view, can they turn around and say to the consumers, you know, you're laying on us a lot of expectations, we have some of you, and what might those be?
Very good. Let's go back to 1985. Agriculture was in grave difficulty. Again, as I mentioned before, that we were dealing with a lot of excess debt in agriculture, and we had a lot of farmers in deep financial difficulty. And there was general understanding at that time that we needed to help farmers. You know, that's the point. There was general understanding in society that we needed to help agriculture. And society was willing in 1985 to enter into a farm bill that provided a great deal more direct benefit to farmers. And as I mentioned, $77 billion of direct payments out of the 85 Farm Bill over a five-year period to farmers that were terribly, terribly important in helping us pay down that debt, so that here in 1992, while there still are farmers who are in financial difficulty, we are in a completely different financial world than farmers were in 1985. Now, along with that understanding came the suggestion from environmentalists and conservationists, look, if we're going to provide those additional supports to farmers, shouldn't we get serious about soil conservation? And as a result of that, everyone agreed that that would be a good idea. And so the conservation provisions of the 85 bill were written in, the swamp buster and sod buster provisions were written in, and there you have the, if you will, quid pro quo. So we have lots of evidence, I think, that society has a special feeling for farmers and is willing to do things. How does society know what farmers want done? The negotiations of the Farm Bill. Farmers' representatives, farmers' organizations are involved in those discussions that lead up to the writing of each Farm Bill. So that's the mechanism. I say a primary, not the only mechanism, but a mechanism whereby agriculture presents to the rest of society what it really wants out of this contract. And then, as I've suggested, in 1985 and 1990, there were some new players on the public side stepping up and laying some expectations on the table that were written into that law. So I don't think it is all one-sided. I think that agriculture gets something from the contract, too.
We are close to the end of the program. We have maybe about 4 or 5 minutes left. Our guest this morning is Peter Bloom. He's assistant director of the Illinois Cooperative Extension Service. We're talking about agriculture and its place in society. And we have another caller here. I want to make sure we get in before we end up out of time here on line one. Hello.
Thank you. I appreciate this program. It's been very interesting on an important subject. I want to make one comment about the movie film which was produced, The Price of Bounty. To me, that didn't do much to clarify my thinking regarding the role of agriculture and its response to society, its role. I heard a lot of opinions of various people as to what the contamination may be from agriculture, what the price of bounty may be, but I heard very little data. Heard a lot of going around the bush, for example, the fertilizer plant out in the western part of the state. It was mentioned about the sad conditions around that fertilizer plant and that it contributed to groundwater pollution. A comment was also made, but the agriculture also contributes. I ended up with no clear feeling as to whether one was more important than the other, whether either one of them was important, and so on. So I just suggest that perhaps improvement would show that you are strictly a scientific organization, university. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, very good. The price of bounty certainly has been a bit of a lightning rod for the college and for Extension. And we've had a number of people express concern. We've had people from the agrochemical industry. We've had farmers. We've also had, by the way, environmentalists who take a good deal of exception to the way environmentalists are portrayed in the videotape. There are a number of things that we would do differently if we were starting that project over. First of all, the project should be and is part of a larger public policy education effort. And so one activity, one event, one product just doesn't make a program. It's only part of it. Probably it was our intention that videotape would show different perspectives on that issue. And that probably should have been made plainer up front, that we're not talking here about only scientific data, but we're trying to expose the viewer to a range of perceptions about these issues. That was not clearly done. There is a second videotape on best management practices that are being used in agriculture to address that. Unfortunately, that's just not as interesting to general viewers as the topic of the price of bounty. So I think we're really we're sitting back and trying to understand all that we've learned from that. One of the difficulties is that there were some red flags in the price of bounty that caused mines to shut. We need to do a better job of identifying those red flags, because the whole thing is intended to be an educational effort. And if there are things within the product that detract from that educational impact, then we need to try to identify those up front. But I think it will be one of the things that has been suggested is we need to wait about 10 years and then put that videotape on again and have another look at it and see whether it's a good videotape, because it's been suggested that it'll be 5 or 10 years before we really know whether that was a good videotape. And, of course, it is a limited medium. You know, even a 50-minute videotape is fairly limited in what it can really accomplish. But thank you very much for those comments.
I think it's one more caller here, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Got a comment. Most farmers belong to the Farm Bureau because it's the best insurance policy, and you have to belong to Farm Bureau to get the insurance. But what I had in mind, the government mandates that we do something, and I got two things in mind. We can't do anything with used oil. We can bring it home, but when it's used, it's a hazardous material, and we can't move it legally, and nobody wants to take used oil back. Same thing with used antifreeze. What are you going to do with it? The government has said we can't, and we're willing to comply, but the government hasn't done anything to help us get rid of it. Mm-hmm. Now your comment.
Yeah, I really have no, I have no solution to that. I suggest that all of us have that same problem with our used oil and our antifreeze. Generally, we're not changing those things ourselves. In fact, I think a lot of people are now using the businesses that have sprung up to do that, and then the business has the responsibility of dealing with it. But
yeah, you're going to have me take my tractors into Decatur?
No, certainly not. You're really pointing out the challenges that all of us are going to face as we try to work out a way of living that is much more consistent with the environmental requirements of our surroundings. What are we going to do with our oil? What are we going to do with our antifreeze? What are we going to do with our solid waste? As one of the earlier callers said, these are huge problems that we've got to find a way to deal with them effectively. All of us are in that together.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We've having raised maybe some large questions and not come up with answers for them, but maybe we didn't really expect we could, other than get people thinking about these things. And we appreciate you coming by, and I'm sure that there'll be topics we'll be talking about a lot in the future, and perhaps we'll have a chance to talk again on another day. So we appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David.
Our guest this morning, Peter Bloom, is Assistant Director of Illinois Cooperative Extension Service.